Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And now a discussion of something which really demonstrates what our partner, The New York Times, does so well. The FBI's notorious terrorism watch list. Most Americans probably heard about it in some detail after the September 11th attacks. A watch list. Terrorists. Suspected folks who maybe shouldn't get on airplanes. That sort of thing. It makes perfect sense. But the Times this morning tackled a very basic question. How do you get on that terrorism watch list? And what does it take to get off? An exclusive report now that was detailed by a Freedom of Information Act request that delivered some documents that reveal for the first time how law enforcement adds and removes names from that list. According to the documents, the FBI is permitted to put people on the list even if they've been acquitted of terrorism-related charges. Just one of the interesting revelations in a story exclusively in the New York Times. Charlie Savage, reporter for our partner, joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. He reported this story. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
What kinds of questions did you want to ask about the terrorism watch list that began to frame this story?
Well, there's not a lot that had been publicly known about exactly what is involved in this list. What are the procedures for getting on it? Who makes the decision? How do you get off of it? What are police supposed to do if they encounter someone at a traffic stop and their name comes back as a hit on the watch list? And so this release by the Federal Bureau of Investigation through a Freedom of Information request by a civil liberties think tank here in town was extraordinarily interesting. The FBI decided, without a lawsuit, to lift the veil on a lot of the sort of guts and details of this program. They don't obviously say who's on it or what the intelligence is about any specific individual. It's more just how does it work, and that's pretty fascinating.
And it's fascinating partly because the terrorism watch list is very, very secret. As you suggest, we don't know who's on it, and people who are on it may not even know that they're on it. Yet to be on that list has consequences, and so the question of who gets on and why is almost a judicial matter in the sense that one might think that a court would be required to determine whether someone should be on the list or how you get off. Is it easy to get on this list?
Well, there's lots of layers of review, I'm told, and the documents show as well, and there's a certain amount of suspicion that has to be met, a standard that has to be met. So mere hunches are not enough. It turns out the procedure is if you're whether any part of the government, whether it's FBI agent or CIA or whatnot, you have to meet a certain standard that they call reasonable suspicion or particularized derogatory information. And that means that someone has to, for example, have alleged that you have some sort of ties to terrorism. Maybe you're an operative or maybe you're a financier or sympathizer or something, and that has to have been corroborated by some other source. So single source reporting is not good enough. And then once you have the two sources that say this person is, there's reason to be suspicious of this person, that meets the standard and you can go on the list. And right now there's about 420,000 names on the list. The vast majority of them are non-U.S. citizens, mostly overseas, but about 8,000 of them are U.S. citizens.
Well, for the 8,000 U.S. citizens, we should note that being on the list does not constitute a prosecutable crime. Does the reasonable suspicion test match the kinds of things that would, say, trigger a warrant for a wiretap, for that sort of thing?
I think that you could probably get a warrant for a wiretap if you had an FBI investigation into someone and there were two different sources saying that they seem to have some kind of links to a terrorist group. Within the jargon of the FBI, they have three different layers of investigation. The middle layer is preliminary investigation, and that standard is allowed to use wiretaps, and this it also meets this basis.
Charlie, as much as you were able to determine, and we're talking with Charlie Savage, reporter for our partner in the New York Times, who authored an exclusive report on the terrorism watch list of the FBI in today's paper, as best as you're able to determine, what are the consequences of being on the list? We know you can't get on a plane, but can you run for Congress? Can you be a Sunday school teacher? I mean, what's the story?
All right. Well, so there's a couple things to understand about this. So after 9/11, it turned out that the CIA had grown suspicious of a couple of people and who were involved in Al Qaeda and didn't tell the FBI about that. And then it turns out that they were in this country and had even been stopped by traffic police at a couple of times, and there was no way of knowing that they attracted the CIA's suspicion, so no one did anything, and then they turned out to be 9/11 hijackers. And so that sort of enormous problem created this impetus to have a government-wide, unified, consolidated system for if one agency has grown suspicious of someone, every other agency has a way of knowing that. And so in 2003, the Terrorist Screening Center was set up in the FBI, and it sort of is the guardian and keeper of this master list. And then they farm out that data. They decide, you know, when an agency nominates someone to go on the list, they make the decision about whether or not to do it. They make the decision about whether or not it's time to take someone off the list. And then they farm out that data to different agencies for various purposes. So the State Department uses it when they are reviewing visa applicants to come to this country. The Customs and Border Protection Agency uses it when they're screening people who are trying to cross the border into the United States. The TSA uses it when they're screening airline passengers and airline crew.
What about local cops?
And local cops use it when they pull people over and they, you know, they're checking your, they're sitting in the car behind you and they're checking your license plate. One of the things that's happening is they're dinging your name against this list to see whether you are on it. And even within this list, there's different sort of subsets of what happens. And so the no-fly list is not all 420,000. The no-fly list has about 16,000 names on it, of whom about 500 are American.
Interesting. Before we go, the most controversial headline we've been reporting this morning is that you can stay on the list even if you've been acquitted of terrorism-related charges. Before we go, what's that all about?
Right. So even if you're suspicious of someone for, and then you charge them and then the jury finds that they're not guilty, the FBI procedures allow them to keep them on this list and continue to sort of subject them to greater scrutiny and questioning or even keep them off planes in certain cases. And that's because there's a different standard for putting someone in jail and putting them on extra scrutiny. One is beyond a reasonable doubt. The other is reasonable suspicion.
Interesting. So it might be easier to get on and harder to get off that terrorism watch list of the FBI, the details of which are explored in an exclusive report in the New York Times written by our guest and partner reporter, Charlie Savage, reporter for the New York Times. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.